you know, it's interesting, the Galatians 5 passage, after the fruit of the Spirit description, Paul says, you know, if we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step with the Spirit. And that phrase keep in step is like a single Greek word that was a military term to describe how Roman military, like Roman legions, they had this particular way of aligning themselves, which made them essentially like unbeatable in battle. It's like a really hyper practical, like align your life in this particular way. And I think we need to do that. We can't just have good intentions. Willpower is not enough, as you have taught so many of us. Like you have to actually take steps toward making real change in your life.
What's the lure? What is it that's addictive or compulsive or whatever word folks want to use to these little screens?
A lot of it is just, I hate to be bored. We hate to be bored.
This is the quickest escape possible from boredom.
The device in my hand will help me fight the enemy of boredom. And I think that's the mistake. Boredom is not our enemy. Boredom is our ally.
Thank God for technology. What an incredible gift it is. I'm sitting in a hotel room someplace. Jay Kim, my friend, and he was my pastor, and Nancy, my pastor, when we lived in San Jose up until this past year, is sitting in a hotel room someplace else. We get to talk to each other face to face and get to record this for all of you. So technology is a great gift, and it is one of the great challenges of our lives. So that's part of what we're going to talk about today. Jay has written a wonderful book called Analog Christian and is in the Bay Area. So he lives in the heart of what's going on with technology and is a remarkable thinker, preacher, writer. Jay, thank you so much for agreeing to talk for a while.
Oh, of course, John. Anytime. Love any chance I get to be with you.
Well, it's always a great joy. I'm actually in the Bay Area at the moment and met with a bunch of pastors, preachers, talking about preaching last night. So your presence and face and influence was all over the room.
Yeah, I'm bummed that I'm not there. We just missed each other. So, but here we are, technology.
Yep. So let's talk about that. We're become new, working on that line from the psalmist, Lord, teach us to number our days so that we may gain a heart of wisdom. And you write in Analog Christian about, in your own personal journey, feeling that qualities like resilience and contentment and wisdom were kind of being put at risk, just looking, particularly during the pandemic, but more than that, at the impact that social media, online technology has. You quote Gene Twenge, who's one of the great writers on this subject, who says that we are on the brink of a mental health crisis that we have not seen in decades, and that a lot of that seems to be connected to technology. And there's a lot of talk about that. Is she exaggerating? Is it really that bad? What is the impact of technology on us, and why does it work the way it does?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the more recent data, she wrote those words, you know, a while ago, over a decade ago, I believe. The more recent data from people like Jonathan Haidt, Anxious Generation, I think a lot of folks know him from that book, but he's been writing extensively about what's happening in our cultural moment. You know, to me, my estimation, the data seems so abundantly clear and in many ways undeniable at this point that she was right. Gene Twenge was right that we are in a mental health crisis in large part due to the rise of the smartphone and specifically social media. And, you know, from my own personal experience, beyond the data, just my own personal experience, and as a pastor, the great gift I have of hearing the stories of people in our congregation, it seems as though the strange, ubiquitous vortex that almost all of us find ourselves in the digital age with social media and just the changing of media as a whole seems to have thrust us into this vortex where you know, self-centric despair leads to comparison and contempt and on, and we're becoming increasingly fragile, increasingly unwise. We're addicted. I think the data bears that out. You know, it's interesting that word addict comes from a Latin word that at the time of Jesus was used to describe slaves. It was a legal term. So we're enslaved, you know. I mean, I'll admit it often. I have to reckon with my own sort of enslavement to my digital addictions. And I think that awareness is really key. Like you and I have already said, technology in and of itself is not evil or vile. Although some of the design, you know, there might be some ethical questions we can ask. But all in all, technology can become a really useful tool when we use it appropriately. But I think we're in a time when technology uses us more than we use it. And I think we have to talk about that.
Yeah, you have a line in the book where you talk about the problem isn't technology, the problem is us.
Yeah.
And I was also very struck by when you talked about how the apps we are using us, and we're not so much the customers as we are the products. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, that comes from the work of a man named Tristan Harris, who is by trade a design ethicist. So what that means is his life's work is committed to asking ethical questions about digital design, how we design applications.
His vocation is a design ethicist? I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, it's a thing. Well, his story is fascinating. He leads an organization now called the Center for Humane Technology. In other words, he wants to help us make technology a tool that leads to deeper human flourishing. And the reason he did that was because he was actually, this is all public, he was actually hired by Google many years ago. This is not, you know, I'm not throwing shade at Google. I use Google, but this is the story. He was hired by Google to lead an ethics team at Google. He left after a number of years, publicly stating that he realized he could no longer do the work because Google, it damaged their bottom line to instill ethics into their design. And so he was never really allowed to do the things that he proposed. So he left and started the center. And there's a whole movement around it. And that line comes from him. He basically says, you know, we open our apps on our phones, and just about every social media app you can find is free. Like you just download it. There's no cost. You don't have to double click to pay for Instagram or Facebook or whatever. You just don't have to do that. You don't have to pay. But he says nothing is free. If an application is free, then it means you are the product being sold and bought. You are the source of commerce. And he's got lots of brilliant thoughts on it, but I think it's true. You know, we think that these are just sort of benign applications on our phones. And if we're not careful, we become the commodity that's being bought and sold. Specifically, he would say, and I would agree, it's our attention. Our attention is the commodity. He calls it an attention economy. That's the era we're living in. And so again, you know, paying attention to that and reclaiming our attention, I think, is probably one of the first steps.
So part of what I love about the book is that as you're reflecting on your desire for contentment, resilience, and wisdom, and the sense that it's kind of getting lost, you end up contrasting a lot of the characteristics that seem to get reinforced online with the fruit of the Spirit. And I want to read a quick summary, and then you can just comment on whatever you want to. So the door is wide open. But you talk about what we're experiencing in the digital age and what we actually need from God. And then you walk through the fruit of the Spirit. We need love instead of self-centric despair. That's a very striking phrase. So you might say a word about that. Joy instead of comparison. And it does seem like there's something about the nature of social media that makes comparison kind of the national pastime. Peace instead of contempt. And all of those things lead to a life of contentment. Patience instead of impatience. You know, if it takes my computer 5 seconds to boot up, like that's just too much to tolerate. Kindness and goodness instead of hostility, leading to a life of resilience. faithfulness instead of forgetfulness, gentleness instead of outrage, self-control instead of reckless indulgence, leading to a life of wisdom. And it was very striking to me going through that, how powerful the fruit of the Spirit is. And you know, the goal at Become New is just, how do we grow spiritually one day at a time? So as you're listening to this, you might think about in the fruit of the Spirit, where is God speaking to you? What do I need love today? Do I need joy today? And so, but the contrast between that and what often ends up getting surfaced online was very striking. How did you make that connection, and where did that come from in your own life? And jumping off there, what parts of that would you like to address?
Yeah, I mean, where it came from was just my own increasing recognition of these symptoms of my own digital addiction over many years. I just started naming them. Like, why do I, you know, it never starts with such clarity. I didn't wake up one day, pick up my smartphone and think to myself, man, this is a device that leads me to self-centric despair, but here I go, I'm just going to open it anyways. You know, it was just a feeling. Like I would find myself mindlessly scrolling. And there was something in me that felt so off. I just, you know, most people can relate to this. You sort of doom scroll your media feed of choice or your social media feed or whatever, and you're seeing all of your friends, you know, posting their highlights and their vacationing in the Maldives or something, and you're sitting in your cubicle and you're just like, there's something about it. You click the heart button to let them know you like that they're having a great time, but you don't really feel that way. You know, I didn't really feel that way. It's like, why did I click that? I don't actually like that.
Right.
You know, I'm actually overcome with envy and
I'm a loser.
Yeah. What's wrong with my life? How come my life doesn't look like their glossy sort of highlight reel? Even though intellectually I knew that's just their sort of filtered, curated, glossy highlight reel. I knew their lives aren't always like that. And when I was doom scrolling Twitter or X or whatever, I also knew intellectually, well, not all the world is in absolute chaos and upward. There is much that is wrong in the world, but it's not, the ratio is not what Twitter tells me it is, that everything is just going absolutely wrong. And I found myself, I think hopefully people can relate to this, I think they can. I also found myself in the midst of that detaching from my actual lived life. There's like this, the gift of this life that I have been given. You know, I think often of that incredible line toward the end of Mary Oliver's poem, The Summer Day, where she asks the question, so tell me, what will you do with this one wild and precious life that you've been given? And I found myself like, you know what? There are things I want to say that I will do that sound beautiful and poetic. But if I were to be honest about what I'm actually doing with this one wild and precious life,
yeah,
I'm just scrolling. I'm scrolling myself into despair, fueled by comparison, mm-hmm, and contempt. And that was leading to a complete loss of contentment in the one wild and precious life that I've been given. And so on and so forth. You know, impatience and hostility and forget. I just realized, man, I have no resilience. I cannot wait. The writer Nicholas Carr, in his book, The Shallows, he talks about how we have, in the digital age, because of our devices, we have now acclimated to becoming, we've become people who just jet ski on the surface of life, and we never dive deep. You know, you can think about the difference between scuba diving and jet skiing. If you want to cover a lot of ground on the surface, get on a jet ski and go. But you will never know the depths of the ocean. To do that, you've got to put on the gear and you've got to go slowly down deep. And I was realizing I have lost my aptitude and ability to go deep, with good things and with hard things. And so just all of this stuff, I first came to an awareness, man, something is being malformed in me. And I knew, I just had a sense, man, God has something to say about this.
So really, and in thinking about your journey with this, self-awareness, self-assessment, just trying to find some kind of gauge about how is it with my soul, And then identifying some of these qualities like love versus self-centric despair, or joy versus discontent and envy. You have a great quote from somebody, I think Jerry Saltz is his name. You've got to make an enemy of envy today. Mm-hmm. By tonight, it will eat you alive.
Yeah. Yeah. I think envy or comparison, it is the thief of joy. You know, we think about joy mostly as just pleasure, but biblically speaking, joy is not that. You know, joy is not a spark. It's not this emotional spark. It's this steady, pervasive sense of well-being, you know, rooted in the goodness and the nearness of God. And to experience deep joy in that way, you have to go deep, and you have to be willing to allow joy to coexist with pain. It's not this like fleeting feeling of happiness. It's a deep abiding sense of happiness. You know, I think all of us want to get to a place where we could scroll our feed in a healthy way, watch as some of our friends are experiencing highlights in their life. I want to be the sort of person that can see those things and not compare and contrast, not envy, but instead feel genuine joy for those friends. And that's a struggle all the time, but it is a practice. We have to practice that. We have to do the work of, you know, relinquishing this sort of cultural myth that if my life somehow doesn't measure up to everyone else's highlight reel, that my life is for some reason not worth living. And again, remind ourselves, your one life is wild and it is precious, and it is the gift God has given you. And when we can settle into that reality, I think real deep abiding joy is possible. So for me, just, you know, when I read the Galatians 5 passage about the fruit of the Spirit, I'd read that passage so many times. I'd had it memorized, you know, that the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, and on. But when I read it in light of these thoughts and this own sort of internal conflict, it really just clicked with immediacy for me. Like, oh, this is the answer. I need to invite the Spirit of God to do real deep inner work and live with an awareness of the work that the Spirit wants to do. Now, if I can do that every morning, then I have a chance, you know, to make it through this wild thing that we call the digital age.
So if a first step is kind of becoming awareness, and the fruit of the Spirit is a wonderful contrast to the ways that I could misuse my one wild, crazy life, then what do you do to help counteract? How do you navigate online technology? How much time do you spend with it? What boundaries do you put around it? You're a pastor, so you watch all this stuff in the congregation, and you're in the heart of the center of technology in the Bay Area. So for somebody who's listening to us right now, you know, we're actually using technology to have this conversation and hopefully for them to be pointed towards God. How do you shepherd people to navigate technology wisely?
I'll get really sort of nuts and bolts and practical here. I'm borrowing this from our friend Andy Crouch, who in his book, The Tech-Wise Life, a number of years ago, proposes a paradigm and a practice that I found immensely helpful. Really, truly, I would say it changed my life. He suggests a rhythm of digital Sabbath. And the suggestion he makes is commit to 1 hour a day, one waking hour a day, one day a week, and then 1 week a year. And what he means by that is commit calendar, one specific waking hour a day when you will shut off all digital engagement, and then commit one full day a week. So for me, when we started that as a family, that was Saturdays when I was with my family. It's my Sabbath. We had no digital technology around, and then 1 week a year. So for me as a pastor, I typically will take 3 to 4 weeks off every summer. And it was one full week of that break that I just had no digital engagement. And, you know, it's interesting. At first, I think it's really, you know, John, you know, you've done so much work along these lines with steps and, you know, this like 12-step programs. The very first step, I've learned this in such beautiful ways from you. The very first step is to admit that we were powerless. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that this sort of initial digital Sabbath sort of detox did for me was it forced me to reckon with the depth of my addiction. So when I first started this, that 1 hour a day was like impossibly long. That one day a week, my hands were just jittery. I was constantly reaching for the phone.
You had the itch.
Yeah. And then the 1 week a year, I was like, how am I going to make it through? This is insane. How can I live my life just surrounded by embodied humans? I need digital, whatever, you know? And it forced me to say, you know, I'm powerless against this. I need the spirit to cultivate fruit in me.
That's so good, yes.
And over time, God is so faithful. The spirit began and continues to cultivate that fruit in me. So I think starting somewhere like that, one, just being ready, it's going to be impossibly difficult at first for most of us, not for all of us, but for most of us. But now, several years into it, you know, it's much longer than 1 hour a day. It's more than a day a week for me. And I'm about to go on sabbatical for the next month. And I'll have my smartphone so that I can get directions and, you know, use Google Maps. But I will not have my email, nor will I have any of my social media on. One very practical thing I would recommend, there are several companies that do this, but I have a device that I ordered online called the Brick, and it's a magnet that sits on my refrigerator. And every morning before I leave for the office, I open my Brick app and I turn it on. And what it does is it shuts down all of my applications on my phone that I have pre-selected. So anything that will be a distraction device for me shuts down. So during the workday now, the only things that are up and available on my phone are just basic essentials: text, phone calls, Google Maps, things like that. And there's no social media, there's no news app, there are no games. I don't have games on my phone anyways, but there none of that. It all shuts down. So I really have, like, you know, 8 hours a day where my phone just is kind of a dummy phone, you know? And so there's lots of tools out there, but I think we, you know, it's interesting, the Galatians 5 passage, after the fruit of the Spirit description, Paul says, you know, if we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step with the Spirit. And that phrase keep in step is like a single Greek word that was a military term to describe how Roman military, like Roman legions, they had this particular way of aligning themselves, which made them essentially like unbeatable in battle. It's like a really hyper practical, like align your life in this particular way. And I think we need to do that. We can't just have good intentions. Willpower is not enough, as you have taught so many of us. Like, you have to actually take steps toward making real change in your life.
What struck me as you were talking about that and thinking about what's the lure, what is it that's addictive or compulsive or whatever word folks want to use to these little screens? And it sounds so simple and superficial, but a lot of it is just, I hate to be bored. We hate to be bored. And this is the quickest escape possible from boredom, although it doesn't lead to that crazy life. You know, it's striking. Binge watching has become a thing. Streaming has become a thing. And we can spend all kinds of time, but you never watch a movie about somebody who's watching a screen. When you watch a movie, the person that we're watching is not doing what we're doing. They're actually engaging in the real world in life. So we're watching people do stuff that we're not doing, and we would never watch somebody do what it is that we're doing. And it does seem like a fair chunk of it is just part of what's needed in our day, because it's so easy to outsource it or escape it, is the willingness to experience a certain level of boredom while I am kind of retraining my mind to be able to manage consciousness.
Yeah. You know, boredom, I totally agree. You're right. These devices help us fight what we think is our enemy, boredom. It's like, I'm bored, I'm at this red light, so here is my ally. The device in my hand will help me fight the enemy of boredom. And I think that's the mistake. Boredom is not our enemy. Boredom is our ally, because I think when we allow boredom to do its work, it leads us to deeper imagination. The device can never help you imagine. It actually fights against imagination because it just fills your mind with content, like pre-made content. That is not your mind. It's not your heart. It's not your experience creating something new in the world. It's you just receiving whatever was made for you. And now, algorithmically made for you to keep you scrolling. And unless we allow boredom to become our ally and to do the work, one of my great fears is that we are going to become a culture without real imagination. And how heartbreaking would that be? Like all of the great works of art and literature and music and even just human interaction and relationship, the stories that buoy our culture, like it came from imagination, expansive imagination. And I have found boredom is the path. I mean, you and I are both preachers and teachers, and I am bored every time I go about writing a sermon. Like every time there is boredom that is a part of it. It's like I'm just staring, like I don't know,
Yes, I'm
but I've
often
got to
bored
let it
when
do
I'm
its work.
preaching a sermon, and that's a really bad sign.
That's right. That's right. So yeah, I think that's a great point. We gotta let boredom
I
do its work.
remember when our kids were little, sometimes there would be that complaint, I'm bored. And my wife Nancy, always her response would be, well, that's a real problem. You're gonna have to figure that one out. How are you gonna deal with that? Even years ago, screens, just TV, there were enough ways to shortcut escaping boredom that what that means then is paradoxically, our capacity for boredom keeps going up. In the ancient world, Eugene Peterson used to write about this, that essentially the word boredom did not exist in the ancient world. And we look at that and go, well, that's weird, because they had to be bored all the time. They had nothing to do. They had no screens. They had no movies. They had no Netflix. Most of them couldn't read, but didn't occur to them to be bored because their mind had to develop the muscles of focusing on something. And they would love to memorize stuff because it was fun, because they had nothing better to do. And so for folks who are watching us today, to be willing to be bored, and to allow that to stimulate you. To have your mind be renewed in ways that flow out of the real world and your one wild life, and meeting God in the midst of it. But it's almost like that's I have to start by saying I will be willing to be bored, and engage in life, in the midst of the challenge of that.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think, you know, when it comes to relationships, boredom can feel awkward.
Yeah,
And you
people are
know, you
boring,
think.
especially if you're an introvert, and I tend to be that way, and you tend to be that way. That's part of the problem. But Alex, another thing, like with Nancy, my wife, it's just fun to watch her in conversation, and she is a brilliant question asker and conversationalist. And her analog to it will be, oh, having a conversation with somebody is like watching a movie. So it'll feel as she's getting into it, like there's a deep interest. I have to work at that more. It doesn't come as naturally to me, but I get a lot more meaning and satisfaction out of a conversation like that than I might just have occupy my mind on a screen.
You know, Nancy, those who know Nancy, she is never boring. I cannot recall having a conversation with her where at any point I was bored. And you know what's interesting about that, as I think about Nancy, it's not because she always has such incredibly interesting things to say, although she often has interesting things to say. It's not all the time. What I love about Nancy is, and the reason I think I'm never bored any moment I'm with her, is because she is insatiably curious. She is excavating to the depths. It's almost, for anyone who's spent time with Nancy, you know what I'm talking about. She is relentless in digging deeper. Mm-hmm. Like she's wanting to know more. Tell me more. That's interesting. That's fascinating. Making connections. That makes me think of this. And that's imagination. Yeah. You know, that's imagination. It's not just, here's what I read, here you go, and that's that. That's boring. Yeah. You know, that's actually boring.
Yeah.
And I think all of us can do that. Like, curiosity is this untapped, for many of us, this untapped gift in all of us. And it's in all of us. All you got to do is just ask the question, tell me more.
There's a line from G.K. Chesterton where he says, there are no uninteresting subjects, just uninterested people.
Oh, man. Yes.
And, yes. You know, that's true, not just of academic subjects, but of life itself, of creation itself. Yeah. And I think you're right. I think especially of people. And I think now about Nancy, honestly, occasionally I wish she was a little bit boring, but I'll think about her or other friends, people that I know will be watching this right now that just have a capacity for life and a zest for it and an interest in it. And stuff matters and stuff is intriguing. And that's particularly true about people. And so for those of us that have to work harder at it, to be willing to work harder at it, and really, you know, that gets deeply to the central, you know, primary fruit of the spirit, which is love. You talk about two questions that we need to ask ourselves when it comes to people. Who is the other in my midst? And then what is required of me to will their good? And it strikes me that, as you're saying with Nancy, because there's such a deep interest in people, and it's just unforced, it's just there, it naturally leads to, oh, I care about you. And I want to know about your relationships, if you're married or you have kids, I want to know about that. If not, your work, what your dreams are. And finding out those things, what John Gottman used to call a love map. You know, I'm just finding out details about somebody. And as I do, it matters. And, oh, this is good. No, this is terrible. So what's required of me to will the good of this person, you know, with that question, which I thought is such a great question, because it can't just be, I got to whip myself harder to will the good for people more. If it's going to be sustainable, I need to be drawn for that. And so a big part of what's required is to know more about you. And if I'm going to know more about you, a big part of that is that I'm just genuinely curious and I want to know more.
Yeah. Yeah. This desire for connection, I think it grows through curiosity. Yeah, I totally agree. And you and I, like you said earlier, we're prone to being a bit more isolated. Yeah. So it does take a little bit more work for us, but even for people like us, when curiosity becomes the lens through which we see all of our relationships, both near and far, those with whom we share real intimacy and those with whom we're just sort of acquaintances, or the barista at Starbucks who wrote your name wrong on your cup, to ask the question, huh, I wonder about their life. Who are they? Where are they from?
Yeah.
Where are they going?
Yeah.
What are their desires?
Yeah.
You know, you think about the C.S. Lewis quote, like, there are no mere mortals.
Yeah.
You know, like Imago Dei, like every person is a gift. And to see life that way expands our imagination. And soon enough, we realize, you know, this is way more exhilarating than this little black box in my back pocket.
Jay, it's so rich. I never made this connection or thought about this before either. One of the big differences between being with a person and being with this is I get to be in control of this.
Mm.
And so I don't have to be bored because I can just go to whatever it is that will interest or arouse or whatever with me. Whereas when I'm with the person, I'm not in control. And that very first temptation, going back to the garden, if you eat the fruit, your eyes will be open and you will be like God. You will get to be in control. And so the screen offers me the sense of control that being with another person does not offer me. But it's the person where there is the image of God and where there is life and meaning.
Mm. I just recently read this book by I think he's a German sociologist named Hartmut Rosa. I think that's how you say his name. But the book is called The Uncontrollability of the World. Oh, and he talks about,
oh, what a
he
great.
Talks about how in the, I know the title alone is worth the money. He talks about how in the modern world, because of the way all sorts of things, the Industrial Revolution, technology, all sorts of things have rewired and shaped us, he says that we have come to see all of life, including other human beings, as things to conquer or to master or to subdue so that we can control them. Wow. So that we, and he says, so that we can make use of them. It's really just utility. Yeah. And we don't really think about this, but like, honestly, we think about even other human beings this way. Like, what use is this person to me? And he actually, this is the point I'm trying to make. He says, because of that, we live life as a series of, his words, points of aggression. He says all of life in the modern world is lived in an aggressive posture. Wow. I have to know, but know in order to conquer, master, and make use of. Mm. Not just textbooks, but humans and everything. And it was so poignant when I read it, because I realized, even now after having done some of this work in my own life, I realized, oh man, there is still some of that, much of that in me. This sort of desire to make life controllable and to make it utilitarian, to make it useful to me. And that is, like, just like you said, that is the garden. I saw the fruit and I thought it was good.
Such a contrast to the way of Jesus and the nature of the kingdom and self-surrender and sacrificial yeah. love and dying in order to live. What's his name again? It's The Illusion of Controllability.
The Uncontrollability of the World. Okay. And his last name is Rosa, R-O-S-A, German sociologist. Yeah, I only understood like 50% of the book, but that part was really good.
Yeah, but you were reading it in German, so. Last question, Jay. You're also a dad, and part of what we're talking about, particularly with this series, because technology has made parenting so much more challenging for folks. How do I arrange family life? How do people deal with their children? And we're all, whether it's with our children or grandchildren or niece and nephew or siblings, or thinking about how to be a blessing to children who are facing some real serious challenges growing up in this online world. So what word do you have for parents, as a parent yourself, about how to try to navigate these things well in their parenting?
Yeah, I mean, I guess this word won't be, initially at least, all that inspiring. It'll be more sobering. But the parallel that has been helpful for me, others developed it, but I totally agree. I do think in the years to come, and I think those years are, they might possibly be upon us now because of all of the overwhelming data that's coming out. But in the years to come, I think we're going to realize that these little black boxes that we put in the back pockets of our kids, we're going to look back and think about it like we think about cigarettes now. Mm-hmm. That we're going to look back and say, you know, if you could just imagine buying a pack of Camel cigarettes for a 12-year-old and saying, here you go, you know, you want it, go smoke this. We would never do that. In fact, it's illegal to do that. and I do think we are going to look back at social media in particular and say the same thing. How do we allow 12-year-olds to have social media accounts? And again, I think that day is upon us. You know, many people have read The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. I think, and he's a data scientist. It's not just conjecture. He's not waxing poetic. It's all data science. You know, it's clear that the damaging effects of social media in particular on young children and on teenagers, it's just overwhelming. So just on a personal level, for me and my family, we have a 10-year-old and a soon-to-be 7-year-old. We have already had conversations with our 10-year-old, sort of preemptively instilling in her the expectation. We've said, hey, we're not going to get you a smartphone all the way through high school. You will not have social media accounts. And so getting really nuts and bolts, we have said, this was recommended to us by a dear friend of ours, who actually works at Apple, interestingly enough, he said in his family, he's got teenagers. What he's done is he has gotten his children Apple Watches because you cannot access social media there, but you get some of the essentials. Their kids can call their parents, they can text, and stay in contact that way. They can have their calendar there, but there is no social media. At the same time, I know that's not an option for everybody. You know, technology like that can be very expensive. But there are other ways, I think, to mitigate the sort of, you know, cultural tide and peer pressure that our children are going to feel. Like, what do you mean you don't have an Instagram or Snapchat or whatever? But I think it's really important that we draw the line and we say, hey, we can agree to disagree. But this is for your good, and I want to will your good. And as your mom or your dad, this is the commitment we're going to make. So that's the commitment we're making. And I'm encouraged because I think more and more parents are beginning to lean in that direction.
Well, and Jay, that's just a huge gift to every parent that's watching or listening to know you are not alone. You're not crazy. There's a community of folks that are working on this together, and it's really worth the work. So, Jay, thank you. I was just want to give this thought to people as they go away today. So can you repeat that Mary Oliver line one more time?
Yeah. She says at the end of her poem, The Summer Day, now tell me, what will you do with your one wild and precious life?
So I invite you to take that into today. Just keep talking with God. God, what do you want to do today with my one wild and precious life? Jay, I'm very grateful for your wild and precious life. So thank you for this time.
Thank you so much, John.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes from John. You can also visit our website, becomenew.com, to access all of our videos there or subscribe for the emails that go with each video. But my personal favorite way to stay in the loop with Become New is by text. We will send you a text message every morning that we release a new video with the title of that video and just the link to the video. So if you want that, you can text the word become to the number 855-888-0444 and we'll get those messages to you. If you've got a prayer request, there's a group of us who meet each weekday, Monday through Friday, for 1 hour to pray for viewers just like yourself. So you can text or email us your prayer request at 855-888-0444 or at connect@becomenew.com. Remember, the most important thing about your life is the person you become. We'll see you next time.